Hey guys, before we get the show underway, a couple of announcements. The first announcement is that this is a very different episode. You might have noticed how long it is, among other things. We get into a very in-depth discussion of science fiction. Maybe this isn't normally what we do on Ask an Atheist, but I can tell you that this was something I really... This was good for me. This was good therapy for me, and I hope it's entertaining. And we get into science fiction, optimism, and we get in-depth into why we like certain aspects of science fiction. And as a result, if you've not actually heard or read or watched anything about Dune or Star Trek or Star Wars or anything like that, I guess this should serve as a little bit of a spoiler warning. Other people might tell you that, you know, get with the program already, but I mean, this is me talking. I have not seen any of the new Star Wars movies. So if you have to get with the program, so do I. So I think a spoiler warning is fair. So here it is. But it's a great episode. You should listen anyway. I'd like to do a little bit of a signal boost for a show that comes out of Waveform Orchard Studios as well, and something of interest to myself as well, which is beer. A brewery, it's a Swedish brewery, is honoring the FU I'm Millwall guy from the recent unpleasantness in London. And both Dave of Hands Free Football and I would really like to try it. So if you have access to it, if you can contact the show or contact Hands Free Football at handsfreefootball.com, and maybe we could figure out how to acquire some. That would be kind of a huge help. And thank you very much for listening. So, on with the show. I thought a theremin was appropriate for this section. That's just me. I was in the restroom of my own house and just now, and I noticed, Becky, when did we buy The Gospel According to Twilight?
Oh, I bought The Gospel According to Twilight because it was hilarious. I think at a Goodwill or maybe in a book swap somewhere.
Okay.
Because it's completely unironically written.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's a study.
Not a joke.
To link young people who are super into YA vampire fiction into a completely different kind of fiction.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I know Twilight's now kind of...
passé, maybe?
Passé, but I saw that. Like, what is that? That is like almost the exact opposite of the physics of Star Trek.
I was reorganizing the bookshelves and I thought this would be good. We needed some new bathroom reading and there's nothing better than...
Like all good atheists, I have a bookshelf in my bathroom.
I gotta be honest, the only Gospel According to that I really like is the one according to Biff.
Biff.
Biff. Yeah.
Biff.
Yes. From Back to the Future?
No.
That was mine. Gonna be my guess.
Is this Lamb?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, that one's a fun one. That's a fictional sort of fanfic, humoristic fanfic of the life of Jesus and his traveling buddy Biff.
Yeah.
Well, so obviously...
They're childhood pals.
How are you, Wes?
Lovely, thank you.
Fantastic. And also joining me is Miles Greb again. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm here, so I'm doing great.
Fantastic. He is the creator and writer of the comic After the Gold Rush and was one of the organizers of Seattle's March for Science. At the end of the March for Science interview, I said, I need to have you back on the show to talk science fiction and stuff. And here you are. Thanks for joining us.
I forced you to keep your word.
Oh boy, yeah, twist my arm. I want to talk about science fiction. You'd be surprised. I'm a huge science fiction fan, but I was so monastic about it as a kid. Like, I didn't know until I was an adult that science fiction conventions were a thing.
Yeah.
And that there was like a huge fandom. And the first science fiction convention I ever attended was Worldcon 2000. In Chicago, to give you an idea of how long I went before I realized science fiction was a big deal.
Yeah.
Which was in Chicago, where I'm from, but I had already moved to Arizona.
Sure.
And came back to Chicago for my first science fiction convention, which is a story perhaps for another time.
I grew up in a really small Christian town in the woods, you know, Northern California, so science fiction to me was always kind of a inward-facing fandom, you know?
Yeah.
I didn't have a lot of people to talk to, but obviously everyone, you know, Star Trek or Star Wars, which is more fantasy-bent, but, you know, like, if I want to talk about Dune, mm-hmm. or, you know, I Dream of Electric Sheep or something, you know, it was pretty much me and the librarian, who was a nice, like, 40-year-old woman who would always be like, this is what you want, Miles. And
librarians didn't care for me.
Yeah, I can
see
that.
Yeah, I don't know why. Maybe it was because I knew that the card catalog systems ran AIX and I was always trying to get a shell.
Sure.
That might have been it. But yeah, science fiction was something. I think the first time I ran into people who were also fans of science fiction would have been Rocket Club.
Yeah.
Model Rocket Club.
Cool, cool.
So. But we're here today to talk about your comic book series after the Gold Rush.
Yep. It's a return to optimistic science fiction.
Okay.
And so after the Gold Rush, it follows the last scientist. Mm-hmm. Her name's Scout, and she returns to Earth and she finds it in a state of wilderness. You know, it's not a post-apocalyptic story though. Something else has happened.
Okay.
You know, science has been traded away, but I haven't really explained that yet. You know, that's kind of the hook to get people to keep coming back. So I wanted the book to be focused on hard science, skepticism, and atheism. You know, I'm not trying to be like heavy-handed with the skepticism, atheism stuff. I just want to be clear that the book's set in, you know, the real world, so there's no God.
Right.
And I wanted it to, you know, show a real scientist who's good at a couple fields, not everything, you know.
Right.
She's not a doctor scientist like you see on TV. So she's a biologist and a chemist, and she'll relate to the world in that way. And she grew up, you know, not really knowing what, like, superstitions or theologies were. So when she comes in contact with the people of the world, you know, she's going to see them use alternate medicine or magical thinking or all kinds of hand-waving stuff. And she's going to have to kind of interpret it from, like, someone who grew up in, like, a Star Trek-style world.
Right.
You know, doesn't know about this stuff. So that's kind of the crux of the origin of
the story. And you said she is the last scientist.
She's the last scientist, yeah. So she grew up on Titan, you know, which is one of the moons of Saturn.
Yeah.
She's part of the Beagle 2 expedition there. She was born there, the first child born on Titan. And she was raised to be a biologist with genetically engineering. So she uses, you know, CRISPR is kind of what we're using now.
Yeah.
It's like our new advanced technology for genetic engineering. She uses cold snap, which is, you know, sci-fi term for a futuristic version of it. So, you know, I have a webcomic even, which I've got help. Kevin Folta, the biologist, helps me with the science there. So you can see that. But she ends up going in cryo sleep eventually. And then the ship, the Beagle 2, eventually fail-safes and returns it to Earth. And when she gets there, you know, it's not Star Trek. It's not, you know, that high-tech zone. It's really lush and beautiful. You know, it's not a bunch of abandoned buildings. She finds, you know, fields and trees, and she has to figure out what's going on. And that's kind of how the story gets started.
So you said that Scout is discovering and really exploring the concepts of magical thinking and religious thinking and things like that. But you yourself grew up in a very Christian environment. Did you consult with anyone who maybe did grow up in an atheistic, you know, household or childhood and then encountered religion at a later time to help inform how you might have Scout respond to some of these things?
That's actually a really great question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that question before. No, I didn't. So most people I knew grew up religious, you know, because I'm from Hicksville. You know, up here in Seattle, there's probably some, but I don't know anyone who actually, everyone I knew grew up Christian or at least kind of Christian. So I guess the perspective is just, I just kind of figure out how I think it would go and hopefully it works out good.
So Sam, do you have something stuck in your throat?
Maybe
an atheistic childhood stuck in your throat?
Something like that. Yeah. I would, as someone who did not grow up religious, I would say don't listen to anything that I say at all.
I try my best not to.
Yeah. That's a good idea. Usually. No, cause the thing about, it sounds like she, you know, you said Scout comes from a very, I guess, Star Trek like environment where it's sort of a, I guess would a humanistic view of the world
be? So it's from 2449, you know. Yeah. Like, you know, they're post most, you know, sexist, racism, bigotry problems.
Sure.
You know, they're very science-based society. Everybody's trying to build things and expand the civilization. You know, it's a pretty kind of utopian, humanistic kind of.
So my perspective is meaningless too, because maybe I grew up in a non-theistic household, but we had to basically, I had to have religion explained to me, and I grew up steeped in the American tradition, which is Judeo-Christian.
Sure, the Jesus myth, you know, still, you know it.
Yeah. Right?
Or like, you know about other modalities for medicine and stuff.
Yeah. And so we may be at a distance in terms of American story as far as this sort of thing goes.
Yeah.
But we are a lot closer together. We're practically right next to each other when in the face of somebody like this character.
So So there's like a scene in After the Gold Rush 2, right? So Scout, she meets one of the inhabitants, and Scout's injured, and so he places two eggs next to the door because his mother told him, you know, that if you're sick, if you're going to die, it's because a spook, you know, something that's going to come take your soul.
Right.
But if you trade them two lives for one, they have to take the deal. So two eggs by the door will keep you safe, you know. Scout's first thought when she sees that isn't, oh, that's woo. You know, like we would think.
Right.
She's like, well, if they're doing this, it obviously must work. Because everything she sees anyone does, you know, is based in evidence. So her first thought is, well, what the hell's going on here? And it's to study it, you know, which is a different than how skeptics might see things now. So I wanted to kind of make her a skeptic and atheist, but she's not from our culture. So the way that that will articulate itself into the character and the story wouldn't be the same.
I got to be honest. I mean, I was kind of floored by that when I read it recently. So, yeah, Scout is a very interesting character. So I'm really excited to see where you're going to take her.
Thanks, man.
What were the things that actually helped inform the religious orientation of the Earth inhabitants?
So that's going to be a big deal coming up. The whole thing's going to be revealed in issue 4.
So we can't say, was it your Northern California backwoods upbringing?
So it's not one strict theology, I'll say that. The person who made things the way they are and after the Gold Rush has a very narrative-based way of thinking. He's informed by certain ideas, but it isn't one strict theology. And Earth doesn't have just one religion. That's not what's happening. It's kind of an alliance of hand-waving, I'd say, but that will all be revealed in issue 4.
Fantastic. So you've spoken of it as a return to optimistic science fiction. Mm-hmm. And as a fan of optimistic science fiction, in what way, where do you see science fiction now, and why do you see a need to return to optimistic science fiction?
Sure. So the kind of thing I often say is, you know, it's good to have warnings, but it's better to have goals. And the problem with science fiction often is that we focus kind of dead set on what can go wrong with our technology.
Right.
Which is a shame, because if you look around us, you know, lifespans are increasing. We can talk to each other more. You know, equality is going up. Everything does get better. Although it's easy to focus on the problems, which definitely exist.
Right.
It's a shame we don't kind of celebrate our successes. And I think it's good to, because like there was a survey of people who were signing up to become NASA engineers, you know, a majority of them were inspired by Scotty, because like, look what Scotty can do, you know, and that matters. And so another thing is, I wanted, you know, to have representation of more kind of demographics and After the Gold Rush. So it isn't just, you know, Scotty inspiring people. Hopefully Scout can inspire more girls and girls of color to get engineering as well, because I think that you need that. But aside from just that representation point, I think that you actually need to have scientists doing good work and making the world better. You know, they're not just making T-Rexes and Velociraptors or pathogens that kill everybody. You know, they're making medicine and ships and buildings. Yeah. So
it's really good to see somebody such as Scotty that had such a speech impediment to be able to, you know, get over that. But something that I noticed in your comics,
I'm going to get an email about that. You know, right?
I can hope.
Okay. All right.
I'm not going to see it.
Yes, you will.
Getting hate mail, Captain.
Yes.
Giving it all she's got. But in your comic, though, there's a couple pages in there, you know, talking about dust in the library, which is really interesting tidbits about people from past science mm-hmm. exploration. Can you tell us about those a bit?
Yeah. So, you know, there's normally some reference to a scientist in the book, you know, because she comes from a culture that's all science-based. So obviously they have turns of phrase that mention scientists and stuff. So like in the first book, you know, an arrow comes in the water, so she yells, you know, sweet Mary Anning. And so like, you know, I figure, well, some people don't know who Mary Anning is. So I had the idea of each issue will have an illustrated page, you know, just a little spotlight on a scientist. You know, I think the next one is Stalk, who did penicillin, and then Rosalina Frank is the third one, and we'll do one every issue. Just a little bit of extra hard science in there.
The male character in the second book,
the X-Man,
he gives a small reference to a person also. Could you tell us about that one? Is he just a fictional character?
Try to think what he said. What did I write?
I could swear there was a...
Was that where there's a quote from Sagan, or I know Scout at one point mentions Gregor Mendel.
Yes. And yes, she knows Gregor Mendel. So she knows everybody. I'm trying to think of who the X-Men says. The X-Men does quote things. I don't really want to spoil all of this. Everybody kind of has a book in this society, a book that they're given to kind of base their life on.
Oh, okay.
Everyone's supposed to have one. He doesn't. He has more, the X-Man, but one of these books is Gilgamesh.
Oh, sweet.
And so you may notice that he quotes Gilgamesh sometimes.
Okay.
So what... I agree with you. The cautionary tale is necessary, but it does seem to be the main export of science fiction in nowadays. What do you think... what is it about after the Gold Rush that you think constitutes a return to optimistic science fiction?
Sure. That's a good question. So obviously, you know, there's some direness because, you know, there was something lost, right?
Right.
But the point of this isn't that nothing bad will ever happen because of science. It is the good that science can do. Mm. You're going to see Scout, a biologist and a chemist, come back to Earth. And although, you know, she's a 16-year-old girl, you know, she's not necessarily a leader. She's not a fighter. She, you know, isn't planning to socially engineer or manipulate everybody or be the chosen one. But she knows about something that's really powerful. And that's the ability to test her own biases against the noise of the universe and come to conclusions. And she can apply that to the life sciences. And she's going to implement that to make the world a better place. You know, you'll see changes in agriculture, changes in people's thinking, and, you know, she'll introduce concepts that have been lost, you know, different concepts of rationalism or skepticism or, you know, just humanism, things right. that aren't science, but are inspired what we learn from science. And the reintroduction of that will make the world a better place and will help the people. You can see in issue 2, you know, she makes an antibiotic, which may or may not have helped the X-Men. You know, because she doesn't actually know what... He had a cold, but we don't know what kind of cold.
Right.
Right. So I was waiting for a letter about that. Because I have a section in the back of the book called Peer Review, where I invite people to write in and correct any of the science, you know. So I kind of left that one out there. I was hoping someone would write about antibiotics, you know, being misused.
Right.
But I haven't got that letter yet, so...
Have you gotten letters about the science in the series
yet? I did. I have a lot of different physics ones people ask me, which are the worst because I'm not that great at physics, but I have a friend, Holly, who works at NASA, so I just kind of outsource those questions to her. but yeah, I got quite a few questions. You know, I published one in issue 2 about the way that she makes her inductions when she lands on Earth.
Okay.
Because there's a scene when she takes off her helmet when she first comes to Earth. I wanted to contrast that from the really stupid scene in Prometheus, which is probably the worst sci-fi movie in a long time.
Just in terms of scientific accuracy or storytelling?
No, just like all of it. All of it was bad.
Yeah.
They literally have a line in that movie that says, "Don't be a skeptic."
Yep.
They have a super geologist who's also an amazing engineer get lost. They have a biologist think that an alien life form looks cute, so he tries to touch it and die.
Come here, little guy.
Don't watch Prometheus, unless it's with friends and there's alcohol. Then please watch Prometheus.
You will die of alcohol poisoning.
Yeah, but anyway, so like I had her try to like make inductions before she takes off her helmet. She's like, "Well, there's soul, right? So we're near soul, so that's a good sign. I see a bunch of chlorophyll. There's plants, you know, the only way that can really be is if I'm on Terra." So, you know, she goes through kind of a process. And I mean, to me, that's optimistic science fiction because it's science working.
Right.
So just showing, you know, it doesn't need to be everything sunshine and rainbows for it to be optimistic science. You just need to show it working. You know, like Jurassic Park, great movie. We love Jurassic Park. The other ones suck, but the first one's great. But I mean, still, what's the lesson of Jurassic Park, right? It's, oh, they tamper with nature. Nature knows better.
Right.
No, but that's bullshit. Nature's no damn thing. Nature's just applied physics over time that made itself replicate. That's all nature
right.
is. It doesn't know.
I have a little bit of a debate myself with myself about that. Is it, you know, is it, you know, don't play God or don't play God for the purposes of late stage capitalism or both?
I mean, sure, it can be extra cynical like that, but I mean, I think it'd be beautiful to bring back an extant species.
Yeah.
It's obviously dangerous and we need to be done with caution. And I don't think they had ample caution in Jurassic Park, but you know, they were also trying to make a point.
Right.
You know, it's not
we're doing some of that with the thawing of the permafrost where we have the microbes.
Yeah,
the microbes sort of coming up from the Siberian permafrost.
Yeah.
So we're inadvertently doing that, regardless of whether we can be cautious about it or not.
I'm reminded of a story from way back when I was working operations for an ISP. And they had said they had found a mammoth carcass and they started talking about cloning it. And I had a friend of mine who was very much a spiritualist, very much in the New Age movement. I was kind of I was all the way out of it by that point. And he goes, no, it died. It's over. We shouldn't let it go. And I go, and like, what's the point of bringing back mammoths? And I go, man, a lot of reasons, like mammoth burgers or something like that. And he goes, And I go, dude, mammoth burgers would be great. And then he goes, well, where does it stop? What about the Shroud of Turin? And I just go, dude.
Really?
You can't that's eat what the you brought Shroud. Up.
Like, Jesus burgers?
That's.
Did you really say Jesus burgers?
No, I just said dude and then gave him a look and then he didn't talk
what
to me for the rest
the
of the
What about the Shroud of Turin?
Yeah, well, I was. That's
I like how the Catholic Church knows it's not. Like, they know, but yeah. they don't. Say it's not or is, they're like, well, will you pay for it? That's up to you.
Yeah, the Shroud of Turin and its whatever it is was a conversation that had been going on for some days, which is I think why he had brought it up. But
I wanted to talk a little bit more about Scout's character yeah. and her development. So you said that you hoped that not everyone would have Scotty to look up to, but perhaps Scout.
Sure.
And I wanted to know about the process of developing her.
Yeah. So, you know, the story started, I was at Emerald City Comic Con, and, you know, comics have been really trying to be more inclusive lately. And comics are kind of a spearhead creatively because, you know, smaller budgets.
Yeah.
So they can kind of do things that the big market won't take risks on. So, you know, more queer, trans, you know, different ethnicities in comics have been a big thing, and that's great, but I didn't see any skeptics, no atheists, no hard science, and I was like, well, I should do that. But a couple things is, it's not really realistic to have just a bunch of white people 400, 500 years in the future, because, you know, it's just not going to happen that way. Yeah, as all other countries increase in population, would be more mixed. So I wanted Scout to have a reasonable kind of phenotype, basically, that I think would be there. But I just also thought it was important to, you know, kind of have the main science character just be different than what we normally get. You know, Star Trek's great about being multi-ethnic and having a bunch of different kinds of, you know, different background people in there, but a lot of the main characters are still white guys, you know, and like, it's not like a knock on Star Trek, but it's just good to have a mix. So I thought having Scout, you know, be a younger girl of color would just be important, especially because, like, I'm another white guy in atheism and I can't change that, but I can make a non-white guy fictionally in atheism, you know, so it's not a counterweight, but I don't know, I'm just trying.
No, it's definitely cool. Is her name an homage to Scotty or to other literary characters? I mean, I think of Scout from To Kill a Mockingbird.
Well, that's, yeah, it's always been my favorite name. So I always thought if I had a daughter, I'd name her that. And then I kind of made a daughter, I guess. So that was her name.
It's kind of a cool idea also with the sort of specific job reference to being an explorer. And
yeah,
going,
that was a bit in there too.
So it's cool.
So. Part of it is, so going from the subject matter to mm-hmm. sort of how the thing got made.
Sure.
You had a Kickstarter in 2015
yep.
That netted more than three times your initial goal. How do you think you got that massive support?
Oh, I got really lucky.
Okay.
They let me on...
I was hoping you had some advice for me, man.
No, they let me on Skeptic's Guide to the Universe
yeah.
to talk about it, and that really kind of got me an audience that
That's
I probably
good.
Didn't deserve.
Yeah.
So I was very fortunate. Also, you know, I had the first openly atheist comic.
Mm-hmm.
There was a comic before that had atheist characters, but they were fighting demons, so...
Yeah.
It's not really an atheist book, it's... Not no shade to them or anything.
No.
But so I think that, you know, was kind of good. People were happy to see that. But and also my artist, Isaac LaRosa, is fantastic. And I think people really liked what he was doing, you know, kind of interesting style. It's not quite kind of like cutie, but not quite super serious. It's kind of in between there.
Right.
So it's just kind of energetic look. And I think people really respond to that as well. As well as Barry, who's the cover artist, who's a local artist up here. I mean, I like design the way the cover's going to look, but he made it look awesome. So,
nice.
Yeah.
So how's the current Kickstarter going? You got, when this comes out.
Thanks for asking.
Yeah,
you got like another week and change for people to get in on this, right?
Yeah, so it's just about hit 7,000, you know, so we hit our goal, we make the book. Actually, because we hit our goal so fast in the Kickstarter, I finished paying off the art team. So we're actually done with the colors of the book, so we're lettering it. So, nice. You know, if you back the book, you can get it sooner than normal. So we're going to be about a dozen more days on there. You know, you can go grab the book. If you're new to the series, you can buy all three of them, you know, for just like $25.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, and we have some art prints and we did some variant covers that are kind of cool because I listen to a lot of music when I'm writing. So we did like a Weezer, a White Stripes and Elliott Smith kind of album variant cover for the book. Yeah, and
I saw some of the prints downstairs. They're freaking amazing.
Yeah, thanks, man. I mean, yeah. I didn't make the art, but I do appreciate it. And you know, we have those art prints on there, of course. So you can get the book, you know, digitally, or if you did buy the others and want three, you can just grab three on there. But I, you know, if anyone wants to check it out, I'd really appreciate it. If you want to help support more atheist skeptics and hard science and media, but don't super like comics, you know, giving it a share would really help out, because, you know, the atheism kind of market is only so big. And I can't really get a publisher with an openly atheist book. They don't really want to touch that. So, this is the community that supports and keeps it alive.
I mean, it's, as long as you're on Kickstarter, I mean, you can totally go in and buy it and then put the address to someplace else to send it to a friend as a gift.
Yeah, send it to your kids, man.
Yeah.
Especially if, you know, they're like in an area where it's hard for them to be out about being atheists, you know, or maybe they just don't like to talk about it a lot, but they would like to kind of see an openly atheist character.
Everybody likes presents.
Sure. Also, presents are good. So buy my comic books.
Yeah.
And now at this point, reading comics doesn't necessarily carry a social stigma that it might have a little while ago, maybe 2-3 decades ago. And there's nothing on the cover of your comic that says atheist comics, right?
Yeah.
It kind of is emergent throughout the storyline.
Sure. I don't like to, there's nothing wrong with kind of spotlighting different diverse backgrounds. A lot of people do that. I prefer to kind of normalize it, you know, like I don't really try to make a big deal that Scott's a girl. I really never mention it unless somebody asks me, you know, because why does it matter? And I don't really bring up that she's an atheist a lot unless, of course, you know, it's the subject, because like it doesn't really matter to her. She has no idea what God is. I just want to be open about it, because like when I ask like people at Marvel Comics, you know, well, there's atheist characters in Marvel, but they never say they are. They're like, they're not allowed to say it. So I was like, well, I guess I should say it. So.
So you've mentioned you've got, you know, people who are coloring, people who are mm-hmm. inking. It says, you know, in the documentation, it says you've got an 8-person team. What's the collaboration process like?
Sure. So basically, you know, I write up the script and then I send it to a couple of my science friends to make sure it's not malarkey. And then I change what I need to change. And then, you know, I send them to Isaac LaRosa, and he takes all my notes about how the layout should be, and then he sends me back pencils, and I make notes on it, you know, change some perspectives and stuff, and then he always adds a couple panels I told him not to, and then, you know, we make them inks, and then I send them to the colorist does her thing, and we're like, oh, that's good, but that part's wrong, and then, you know, she fixes it up, and I send it to the letterer, who's in Europe. I have a multinational team.
Yeah.
So, you know, then it gets lettered. And then,
I noticed from your business suit.
Yeah, yeah. And then it comes back to me. And then we have to do all the stuff that I wouldn't have to do if it wasn't self-published. I got to, like, do the math to size up the printing and everything, which sucks, because you got to resize it for all digital and then printing. Mm-hmm. And then we send it off to China. And then China sends it to me. And then I send it to people who paid me to get books.
It's pretty cool process. You have After the Gold Rush, and that's your imagining of the future. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about Clovis?
Yeah. So Clovis is my second story. It's more paleontology. So, you know, the Clovis people, if you don't know, were kind of the predecessors to what we'd call the Native Americans. You know, they were here about 1,400 years ago, so 12,000 BCE. So we don't know a whole lot about their culture. We knew they had these really advanced arrowhead and spear points, so we call them Clovis points. And one of our biggest finds was Anzik, who was a child we found up in the northern states. You know, he's buried with a bunch of different artifacts. And so my story starts with his fictionalized mother burying him. We show the actual burial site with all those artifacts. You know, and she's by herself. She's ethnically of the Clovis people, but she's not within their culture because she's kind of a nomad. That way I don't have to kind of make up a bunch of anthropology, because I kind of felt uncomfortable doing that. Mm. And so she sees a plume of smoke, and she's never really seen one before. So to her, she thinks it's some kind of sign, you know, because, I mean, why wouldn't you? What the hell is that? So she follows it across the wilderness to find her lost son. But on that quest, she meets a megatherium, which were these actual giant sloths that used to exist. And, you know, she ends up befriending him. They kind of go on a journey. He is more charismatic than I can say is scientifically accurate. So that's my one give me. But otherwise,
so are we talking like Sid in Ice Age or?
No. He's a big old sloth, but he acts a bit more like a canine probably in sometimes, you know, because he's kind of chill. But that's probably not reasonable, but
it's not unreasonable. That seems to be a thing about megafauna, is that they tend to be towards the top of the apex, so they don't seem to be in a big hurry.
Sure. You know, so it's not like a total nonsensical thing, but I don't have evidence for some of the way he acts.
Sure.
However, I am very particular about all the megafauna that are there. Like, I don't have anything that wasn't in the right region at the right time. Like, I really wanted to have moas, you know, the big giant predatory birds.
Sure.
Raptor ancestors, but they're not in the right area, so I can't have them. So everything's going to be accurate, and she's going to real locations. Like, all the places she passed are as accurate as I can get. I have a couple different paleontologists, some who work at the Levine Tar Pits in LA, who were helping me with that stuff. So it should be pretty accurate. Also, in the back of the book, I don't know if you guys remember ZooBooks in the 90s, you know, so you'd watch TV, you're watching Rugrats or Rocko's Modern Life, you know, then ZooBooks comes on, big neon colors, and like, learn everything about alligators, and you buy a book, it tells you all about alligators. Very cool. Some people know. Anyway.
There's like a glossary in the back, right?
Yeah,
or something like that.
ZooBooks are fantastic. So we're going to have a ZooBook style section in the back, where I'm going to do all the kind of like infographic actual science about the megafauna. So you read the story, you get the story, then you get some like hard science in the back.
I don't believe I've ever felt older on my show than I do right now.
This is from the 90s, man.
Yeah, it's not watching Nickelodeon in the 90s.
That's all right. It was a great time.
He was doing model rockets in the 90s,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, at least in the beginning. So this stuff is fantastic. If people want to find out more about you and what you're up to, where would I send them?
Sure. So my website's afterthegoldrush.space. You know, all my stuff's on there. Science blogs I write.
Sure.
Stuff. Or at Goldrush Comics, my Twitter. Or if you Google Miles Greb, you can find me on Instagram or me probably yelling about Star Wars somewhere.
So the official interview part of it is over, but that doesn't mean I'm done talking, because there's a lot of stuff I've, you know, just a general science fiction conversation I've always wanted to have on the show. But first, last time you were on, you were talking about the March for Science, mm-hmm. back in April. Any follow-ups to the legacy of the march or anything like that?
Sure. So I think it went really well.
I do, too.
You know, it's a big, messy process. A lot of scientists were not used to being engaged in politics, and there's a lot of people with varying political opinions and kind of temperament who are involved in politics. So obviously that's a combustible, you know, concoction.
Yeah.
So there was pushback against different groups. But I mean, at the end of the day, we had 30 to 35,000 people on the streets of Seattle. With their families, you know, all kinds of people, some scientists, some who just are there to support science because they see what it does. Some people don't know a lot about science, but they just were happy to be there. You know, some people were there because of political reasons, and some people, their jobs are at stake.
Right.
You know, some people there were working at NOAA, and their jobs are at stake.
Yeah.
And there were so many of them out on the street, and they were walking happily, even though there was rain, even though I-5 was terrible that day because there was a big accident. You know, we had the governor there. We had local writers. We had this guy, Miles Greb, who writes comics books. He was talking. He was fantastic. And, you know, I'm just so thankful to all the people that helped me do it, because I think it was a great thing to have a public moment for science.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when's the last time we had one? The World's Fair, probably?
Yeah,
you know?
I would think.
But other than that, we haven't had the let's go out and enjoy science. And obviously, there are things I'd like to change, things I'd like to do better. But we did something that hasn't been done in a long time, and we did it for an important reason. So I feel like I did a good thing, I hope.
Like I said to a couple people who felt like they could have done more or better about the science march. Like science, this sort of thing is an iterative process.
Yeah.
You got to start somewhere. You try it. You figure out what you got wrong, and you improve next time. You just apply the ideas, and it tends to go.
I think that might have kind of always been the conclusion of the science folk who worked for the March of Science.
Yeah.
Because it's not like just a anti-Trump rally or a Save the Trees rally, you know, and everyone's excited because, you know, we're kind of naturally people who question ourselves.
Well, so. I think with the science people is like, no, this isn't, there needs to be something after this as well. Some people seem to be totally on board with that. Some people didn't, but, and that was kind of the conversation I was having afterwards.
Yeah, so there is going to be an organization still afterwards.
Right.
I'm resigning my leadership role,
mm-hmm.
in the march. I will be there to help if anybody needs me, but I just think more voices from more communities should have a role in the March for Science. And so I'm kind of removing myself to make more room for other people to make those decisions.
Right.
Like I said, I'm here to help, but I just want more people to be involved because, you know, we had the big moment that was emotional and community building, but now we need different communities to be engaged, and I can only help with that so much.
Right.
So I hope that it can continue and get more people involved in science, and I wish them the best.
So there's a lot of space then for folks to step up then.
Yes. If people want to get involved, you know, Teresa, Swanson, it was the co-organizer with me. You know, you can contact her or Liz Warfield. And they're wonderful people, and they're trying to get things going. And if anyone wants, you know, any advice on what to do, you can contact me, and I'll give you what I know. So
you're, it sounds like you're a fan of both Star Wars and Star Trek.
I won't talk to you about Star Wars on this podcast.
Why not?
Because, man, that's... Every podcast I'm on, I try not to talk about Star Wars.
Fair enough. Okay.
My thing is that I've been extremely invested in the EU for a really long time, mm-hmm. and I feel a bit ostracized.
Okay.
And so it makes me less rational than I like to be.
Fair.
And so, I don't know, man.
Wait, atheists have emotions?
Yeah, I do.
We have opinions about aesthetics and, and storylines that we like or dislike?
I don't know. So I just... I don't want to be a ranty when I'm trying to sell my book because I'm made a smart science book.
Absolutely.
You know?
No, I understand.
I actually think Revenge of the Sith is a good movie.
Okay.
I think that a lot of the emotion works. If you remove the memes and you actually just sit down and watch Anakin and Obi-Wan fighting, it's a good scene. He's just like, dude, you're my
Shazbot
brother. What the hell are you doing? And he's like totally lost. Like Anakin's not even really responding to his questions. I don't know. I think it works.
I think that might be why those movies are hated so much is that the framework was there. And it just wasn't exploited. Like, like the thing that I make about The Phantom Menace is I like political crap. That should have been a movie I liked.
Yeah.
I was, because what's my favorite modern science fiction television series?
BSG.
And that's all politics. The first episode I saw was Colonial Day, and I was into the show.
We can talk about Star Wars if you want. It's fine.
Okay.
Did you not want to talk about Battlestar Galactica?
No, I don't want to talk about Episode 8.
Okay. I haven't seen Episode 7.
So I'm really emotionally invested in Luke Skywalker.
Okay.
And I'm extremely worried they're going to make the Force postmodernist, which is an exact insult to everything George Lucas has been trying to do his entire
Shazbot
life. Mm-hmm. And it really upsets me because it's like lazy and stupid.
What do you mean by postmodernist?
So the Force isn't just... a dogma. The Jedi aren't a dogma, right?
Right.
The Force is a metaphysical thing. It actually exists. And the Jedi tried to be in balance with the will of the Force to promote the Force spreading through the galaxy and maintaining a balance so it helps life promote. The dark side isn't, you know, just another opinion on that. The dark side pulls it out of balance to use selfishly so that it's not, you know, spreading out. And that's the way it's worked for a long time. You know, like Luke goes on ad nauseum about that. And when he starts the new Jedi Order.
Yeah.
And I think that's really more interesting. It's more Taoist, you know, than kind of like...
I would agree.
Yeah. And I've always really liked that. And KOTOR 2, the video game, had video game writers who wrote all this kind of postmodernist, who's to say it's the dark side bullshit.
Shazbot.
Everybody wants me to play KOTOR. Everybody. Yeah, so, I steadfastly refuse.
Yeah, so you basically had people making a choose your own adventure story, Star Wars bullshit, and people like want that to become Star Wars now.
So are you concerned that they're saying, oh, the dark side isn't necessarily bad, evil, etc. There's two sides to every story, and if we just got in the head of the dark side people, we'd understand that they're fighting for the right thing?
Yeah, and it appears to be what they're doing. And like Luke's whole, like, I want it, the Jedi Order should end thing. I think he's saying like, oh, it was an unuseful dogma. You know, and that just, it. Lucas started Star Wars as an indie film. He started it because he thought science fiction and movies in the 70s were cynical and didn't care about the value of the monomyth anymore. And he thought that he could take all those cliches and actually make them work. And
sure,
he was damn right. And for Disney, the corporation that represents everything that told him he couldn't do it, to buy the mythology and then to change it just upsets me.
As an atheist, wouldn't it make sense, atheist or not, wouldn't it make sense to say that the dogma is the bad? Is there a way to make the argument that the dogma is the problem?
The problem is that the dogma could be a problem.
Yeah.
But see, that's why people are like, oh, Miles, you're an atheist, so why aren't you criticizing the religion part, right?
Right.
Because it's not the same world.
No.
Because the Force is real.
And that's precisely where I was going with the Battlestar Galactica thing, is the way I got hooked on Battlestar Galactica is I was sick, I was on my couch, I was feeling horrible, and I was just watching weird parliamentary procedure that looked like nothing I'd ever seen before, and I'm like, hey, this is pretty good.
Yeah,
I'm kind of into this. I didn't know what channel it was. I'm like, weird military types. I don't know what it is. And then they go on an airlock and explode robots. And I'm like,
Shazbot.
Sold! And I'm like, this is great. And what is it?
BSG is great.
It's Battlestar Galactica? I hated that show.
Yeah, because it was a Mormon show.
Yeah, I hated that show. This is great. And that was the thing that I got a lot, which was, how can you, as an atheist, how do you like that show? God is a character.
Sure.
And I go, because it's fiction?
Yeah.
and fiction is okay. And, you know, and it's it goes going back to Dune. Dune is my favorite science fiction series.
It's mine too.
Hands down.
Yep, not even
it
close.
Is not a world I would want to live in.
No.
Not even not for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, some of the Mentat powers might be cool, but that's about it. It is not a world I would want to live in. Is the Dune world optimistic, do you think?
Yes. And this is why. So Paul Atreides, you know, becomes the messiah that people wanted him to be because they planted religion on Dune. And then he filled into that role.
Right.
And he filled into the role and he used religion to, you know, take back Arrakis for this better state between the Atreides and the Harkonnen, right?
Yeah.
But then what happens? He becomes part of a religious story. And he can't stop the jihad. You know, the ghost, one of the jihad blows at his back. And Paul saw that and knew that and tried to find a way to do that. But as a man, he couldn't because religion's too powerful for any one person to stop after he's playing the role. And the downside of that is mass genocides were committed across the universe.
Right.
You're still not selling me on the optimism thing.
Wait up. It takes a while. It's long books.
Yeah. Long books.
And so, you know, like in Dune Messiah, he even says, you know, Hitler wishes he had his numbers.
Right.
You know, and Paul's very jaded about who he's become.
It's even better than that. Paul talks about Hitler.
Yeah.
And was it Stilgar or was it Korba who said that can't, it was Korba, who can't, it says that he wasn't very good of a conqueror if he only killed that many people, sire. You know, it's like, it was creepy.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, Stilgar has a hard time with it as he sees Paul kind of hate the person he's become. You know, Stilgar doesn't know what to do about it.
Yeah.
You know, he's a good leader and a good man, but he's still a religious zealot. And so eventually Paul, you know, he loses his eyes.
Yep.
And he goes into the desert and he becomes a lost wanderer. By the way, these are huge spoilers, people, but this book is old, so... Yeah.
I'll put a spoiler in this. Yeah, I've done that before.
But here's where the story changes. Paul has a son and a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, his son and daughter agree that his son, Leto II, will go down this vision that he sees.
Right.
You know, Paul had visions. He could see the future, but, you know, there was a limit to this future. Just like you could see the horizon, but you can't see past it. But Leto dared to see past it, and he saw the golden path.
Right.
And the golden path was that the only way for humanity to get past their need for gods, to get to a more humanist state, was for them to know a god. There had to be one,
mm-hmm.
so that they could understand the tyranny and the problem with a hero.
Right.
Like, why you don't want centralized power.
And that what, and I think that's what makes God Emperor so interminable for a lot of mm-hmm. people, but why I think it's central to the entire...
You need it. It's necessary.
It's the axis, because the characters that you see after God Emperor are completely different.
Yeah.
And they have agency that they don't have in the early books. Mm-hmm. They've got access to technologies that they don't have in the early books that were just absolutely prescribed because of static power and theocratic, you know, the weight of a theocratic world.
Yeah, everything changes.
Yeah, and that's where the optimism comes in.
Yep.
If I can,
because eventually they kill God because they make a God.
Yeah,
you know, they were humanity was never able to get rid of the idea because it was always an abstraction. But Leto would do what Paul wouldn't, because Paul actually knew of the golden path.
But Paul was...
He refused it.
But Paul couldn't... Leto couldn't do what he did if Paul hadn't
I'm just talking about the scene in Children, which is my favorite.
Okay.
Dune, where he meets the preacher out in the desert, right?
Yeah.
My favorite scene.
That is a
Dune.
Fantastic scene.
Yeah, thing, and you know, he like goes to him. He's like, oh, father, you know, I know the golden path. He's like, oh, I fucking know, man.
Yeah.
But I ain't doing that.
No.
That's some hard shit, even for me.
Yeah.
And sorry for cursing on you.
No, we have both done that already.
Very well.
Okay.
But yeah, so that's why I think Dune's optimistic. Although, I mean, I understand why someone would criticize that, because you kind of read the whole thing.
Yeah.
To get there.
But it was just such a compelling world, and the characters were so... I'd never seen the narration of characters done like it had been in the first Dune novel. I grant that I was young.
Sure.
But... you got in their heads and you see how they, not just
that dinner scene, right? With Jessica.
Yes, yeah. Exactly that scene where you could see where he actually had all the players at the table and you could see how the chess game was being played by the people who were playing it, because you could see them strategizing and coming up with things, and you could see the power play that was happening right there that a lot of authors couldn't really, the best they could do is subtext.
You get kind of an active view at people's game theory happening.
Yeah.
You know, and nothing really else does that. Other things try.
It was the book that introduced me to metacognition.
That's why I kind of get a little miffed when people compare Game of Thrones to Dune.
Not even.
Because there's like political dealings. I'm like, I don't think you.
No.
You need to read Dune a little closer.
Yeah.
You
know? Oh, man.
But yeah, Dune is fantastic. And if I made a comic of Dune, the first comic in about 40 years anyone's made, it's an adaptation of the third book in Dune. So Dune's like three chapters, right?
Yeah.
So it's the Riding of the Worm tale.
Yeah.
With Stilgar, Chani, and Paul.
Right.
And so I can only do so much of it, but it's free on my website at afterthegoldrush.space. So if people want to check that out, me and Zach Hartong did that together.
Okay. So name a science fiction novel, genre, series that you really liked that wasn't an influence on After the Gold Rush.
Snow Crash?
Really?
I don't think there's any pizza.
No.
After the Gold Rush.
No music, no movies, no microcode?
I don't think I Dream of Electric Sheep is an influence.
Okay.
I don't think Space Odyssey is.
Okay.
Fantastic Four is an influence.
I could see that.
Let me think. I mean, Dune is an influence in how I write the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an influence on the core plot, but when you get to issue 4, which, by the way, is the best issue in the series.
Well, the planet as, like, you know, the planet features fairly, from the art I've seen, the planet features fairly up front and center, and you've got somebody who's in the life sciences. I could feel
a little bit like Kynes, I guess.
Yeah, a little bit like Kynes.
So I wanted Earth to seem alien to Scout.
Okay.
You know, I thought the book would work if it seemed like Scout was an astronaut exploring an alien Earth.
Yeah.
She's only seen Earth from pictures.
Yeah, so she didn't know water was blue, right? In the first book, she has no idea.
Right.
Because, I mean, you think that, but, I mean, you know, she's on Titan.
Right.
So it's methane lakes with our
heck, I lived
sky.
In Chicago. I didn't realize water was blue until I went to the ocean.
You know, it's all new to her.
Like I was in my teens because I thought water was green. Because, you know, St. Patrick's Day and they die in the river.
I have this kind of duality in my life because I'm also really dedicated to Tolkien. My father told me it was real. And
oh, wow.
It was the history of the Earth. So
like pre-Noachian or something like that?
He basically told me that, you know, this is what happened a really long time ago.
Yeah.
Kind of like what people do with Ancient Alien, right? With
society. Yeah.
He's like, yeah, this is how we got to be where we are.
Was this kind of like a Santa Claus myth in your family, or does your father legitimately believe this?
My dad doesn't believe it anymore. I think he was messing with me. But he did tell me that, and I thought it for quite a while. My mom didn't think any of this at all. But I remember in second grade, I raised my hand to ask, like, because we were talking about European geography, basic stuff, and I think we brought up Ireland. I was like, was that where the Shire used to be? You know, and I had to go. I got sent to the principal.
And
I got accused of starting a cult. My mom
geez.
Had to come in and talk to me. My teacher, my principal is very religious. They wouldn't let us watch Hercules, the 90s Hercules at school.
No, I think you might have lucked out there.
Yeah, I like it.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Well, no, I'll shut up then.
It's good. Hydra fight's awesome.
I thought he was better in the first season of Andromeda. Just the first season.
That's fine.
Different Hercules, I think.
Not the
Hercules.
The Disney one, you know, zero to hero, or just like that.
Oh, not the TV show.
No, man. Not the TV show, dude.
I'm not sorry.
Isn't that the guy who's in God's Not Dead?
Yes.
Yes.
Jesus.
Back to your second grade experience for a
minute. Yeah, so Lord of the Rings.
I'm hearing actually like this little tidbit of, you know, little 7-year-old Miles kind of bumping up against a different culture, right? From this like open-minded anthropological perspective. I'm like, oh, that's not how things are? And it kind of like, there's this little reflective bit of Scout in there.
So I think maybe that's why, I mean, I don't know, this is all just pop psychologizing, that's not a word myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I like things to be really wildernessy. Like Clovis is, you know, set in the wilderness after the Gold Rush. She comes back into wilderness. I think that might be a Lord of the Rings influence on me. I don't know.
Yeah, I've noticed that people who like science fiction around here tend to do like the wildernessy stuff. You know, myself, I'd be quite happy on Drantor.
Sure,
I'm more of a city guy, but Foundation novels.
I haven't read the third one.
Okay.
But I like Foundation a lot, and it's kind of funny that they got it exactly wrong. It's just like, yeah, man, in the future there'd be one giant computer.
Yep.
You know, and you're like, no, man, they get smaller.
They get a lot smaller, and they're everywhere.
Although, like in Zoolander, right, they have even super smaller phones, because they thought our phones would get even smaller, but they actually increased in size in Zoolander, so.
Yeah.
You know, a little bit of this and that. predicting. You know, but it's funny how sci-fi predicts stuff, right? Because, like, right. No one predicted the internet. Star Trek's all analog technology.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're all bleeps and bloops and switchies and stuff.
And people who thought about, you know, a lot of sci-fi authors who thought there would be a global data network thought it was going to be either built off of the telephone network, as Arthur sure. C. Clarke did, or a pay-for service, which was literally every other American science fiction yeah. author.
I mean, the whole telephone service, that's kind of what happened in France for a long time.
With the Minitel service. Yeah.
Mintels, yeah.
I think that Mintel. The mistake in science fiction was assuming that our energy storage capabilities would increase kind of like at the pace of Moore's Law.
Right.
And they didn't.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, like, why don't we have flying cars? Well, because they're stupid. But the reason number two is because we don't have a good energy source for a flying car. We don't know how to make it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's not the problem. All the stuff's energy. We just haven't advanced with energy as much as we should.
I think part of it is that I thought that we would continue heavily studying, you know, atomic technology.
Well, that's, you know, one of my bents. I'm a big nuclear power guy.
You and me both.
Yeah. which is another reason why I promote, you know, optimistic science fiction, because I think that, unfortunately, a lot of the pessimistic science fiction, including a lot of the Marvel that I grew up loving, Silver Age Marvel, you know, teaches pseudoscience about radiation.
Absolutely.
And, you know, the whole mutated stuff, it's all bullshit, man.
Yeah.
And
Hulk's not real?
He is real in your heart, and that's okay, what matters to some
you.
People.
Thank you.
So, I mean, like, in actual fact, people die because of pollution and climate change and lack of good energy, right? People die.
Yeah.
And it isn't really too many steps to say that people die because of bad science fiction that promotes pseudoscience. I mean, people promoted fear of radiation. They didn't mean to do anything wrong,
right.
But they did it, and now we don't have nuclear power, and people die because we're on coal instead of nuclear power. So, I mean, there's a real cost to this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not just an abstraction, not just, oh, I think this is better. It's like, we have technologies that we don't use. You know, like, Scout works in genetically modified foods. That's what she does. We, like, in Uganda, the banana crops are going to die.
Yep.
If we don't save them, and this is a Western science, which could help a developing nation, and we can save these jobs, which are mostly women of color who do these jobs, but it is, there's like a roadblock from the left that won't let us do this, which is partly why I wanted to work with the March for Science, because I want to celebrate this work. You know, we demonize it and we are afraid of it, and we should have protective things to make sure we're using it right. That's why we have the FDA. You know, if people have problems, please point them out. But all this fear and cynicism and worry, it just stunts us, because everyone talks about the precautionary principle, right? Well, but what about the cost of inaction?
Right.
That's part of the equation.
I do think it seems a little bit different. The science fiction that I, like I said, the science fiction that I get around here, it's a very different idea, I think, because just the biome that we're in.
Sure. Sorry if I was a downer, my last rant there.
Oh, no.
It was a definite call to action.
Yeah, it's a definite call to action. And I think part of it might be emergent from the kind of science fiction that people, even the science fiction that isn't optimistic
sure.
here. The science fiction that people tend to really like here is very heavy on bioscience, is very heavy sure. on life sciences, and there's life and bio everywhere yeah. and stuff like that. And I think that creates a certain outlook versus, like, when I lived in Arizona and the kind of science fiction that I would read there, and the way I used to describe Arizona, I mean, Arizona's biome was a beautiful, I love it. I kind of am a desert creature. If I had my choice, I would think I would rather live down there.
Hey, you look like a Fremen.
Yeah, no, I don't. I look more like Baron Harkonnen.
Well, Dune was written up here.
It was. Absolutely was. The thing about Arizona is that it's like living on the moon.
Sure.
It's a moon colony.
Well, that's where they tested the yeah. astronauts there.
It's
and in Nevada.
All of the culture comes from somewhere else.
Sure.
It's imported. They had to boost it up
yeah.
here. And then, like, when I was a kid,
and you have completely fabricated biomes inside. You know, you go from one 68-degree air conditioned place.
Yeah,
your air conditioned.
The strongest religion
vehicle.
In Arizona is not Mormonism. It is air conditioning. And it's like I would watch like anime that took place on Mars at home when I was a teenager, and I'm like, oh, that's a real alien world. They did a good job of making it look like Mars. And then I moved to Arizona and I saw the same thing. Like, yeah, it looks like a backyard.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. They turned the pastels up to 11.
Because the place is pastel. It's really interesting to watch when you're in Arizona, and I'm trying, and there's a definite way to connect this to science fiction, and I just can't. Actually, I might be able to. When I moved to Arizona, I bought a house that had been built in the 50s and 60s, and it looked like a very Midwestern suburban house. It had grass, it had the quarter acre that you expect. A driveway, it required a ridiculous amount of water, but it was a house that wouldn't have looked out of place in Iowa, in Illinois, in Saskatchewan. It just looked like, you know, you think standard house, and that was it. And that was, like, very much in the heart of Tempe, which is where I lived. And you moved farther as they built, and as fast as the Phoenix area grew, you could see as you got to newer and newer neighborhoods that they started not trying to make Arizona like Iowa or Chicago or anything like that. Is that they adapted to the ecology of the place. Landscaping gave way to xeriscaping. You know, ranches gave way to much more efficient plans.
I think that's one of the things that makes Dune so good. As far as I know, it's one of the first sci-fis that has ecology as a central part of it.
As a character, even,
yeah,
I would
ecology
say.
Is extremely important. It's not just, oh, they're in a cool alien world that's sand, we got to adapt to sand.
Right.
It's like, it actually matters. It changes their culture. It changes how they talk about things, you know? And, I mean, I don't know. I just think that it's really important to have the actual world be part of what's going on, a part of the world building,
and part of the optimistic science fiction of, you know, the golden era and the silver era that I really love is really literally man goes out into space and remakes the world in his own image, and I say man quite intentionally.
Yeah, because there's also got to be careful because it's a bit of colonialism.
Colonialism.
Yeah, it's in there.
Completely.
I mean, it doesn't. I mean, we say. I think that it's good for humanity to want to expand, but humanity has to expand, like you said, not just man. You know,
right.
That's the problem with colonialism.
And that's but when I think of, wow, what positive science fiction can I show people?
Yeah.
It's all that old stuff that has with it colonialism, male centric, very remaking the world in our image. And as much as I love the Foundation, the Foundation novels, it's very much that. And in fact, Asimov went out of his way to create a universe for the people in that world where it was safe to do that. And then and so what I like about this return to optimistic science fiction that I think is a really good idea is that it's like we've learned maybe what we shouldn't do with science fiction as far as colonialism and maybe phallocentrism. And but we're bringing the I'm joking, but I'm not joking. But we're, you know, the mistakes that we learned with the golden and silver era stuff, and we're bringing it to what we're doing in modern times, I suppose. I lost my eloquence right at the end.
I was thinking of that same thing in parallel when, Miles, you were talking about the most recent March for Science and comparing it to when was the last time we had a big public celebration about science and about, you know, technological advancement being World Fair. And when you look back at World Fairs, you have sort of this, you know, sense of wonder about new technology. But you also, when you look closer, get these icky feelings of, you know, in Seattle World's Fair, they displayed a Filipino man, you know, as a specimen from different races of humans around the world. Yeah. And so you're celebrating this awesome technological advancement mixed with this awful colonialism and racism and things like that. And to say then how that turns, you know, however many decades later into a public celebration of science that is much more inclusive and celebratory, I see that paralleled. You see optimistic science fiction that you were talking about, Sam, that has this tinge of, you know, being male-centric, being colonial in thought, and then maybe several decades later we can return to science fiction but shed a lot of those negative attributes and negative aspects while maintaining the optimism.
That's my hope, and that's kind of like what my life's work is right now, to try to do that. Because, you know, if we're trying to be humanists, you know, if we're trying to like have the ideals that, you know, Roddenberry made in Star Trek, I mean, it's supposed to be about all of us. And last time, like you said, we were optimistic about science. It wasn't about all of us. And it doesn't mean the optimism was bad, but it means we need to fix that. And so we have to be, we need to make sure we actually do, or we'll probably be cynical about it again in the future, because we'll look at the bad parts and see that shadow and not see all the light that's there.
Anything we can do to get away from the science, quote, air quotes around that for goop and such like that, and bring it back to like real hard science. Yeah, that'd be lovely.
Did you guys follow Dan's the whole downstairs. Goop thing that just happened on Twitter like last week?
Not at all.
I didn't know it was a specific thing. I just noticed that the noise
signal to noise ratio
increased significantly.
Yeah.
I know people are getting the herp off of their yoni eggs.
Oh, God.
Cool. So this one doctor, she basically wrote an ad saying, you know, goop don't, science too good.
Yeah.
You know, she used the F word once in it. And so Goop responded with their doctor and chastised her. It was an older male doctor, chastised her for, you know, using the F word and for criticizing them. And then he explained the scientific method to her. She's a working doctor.
Right. So using a curse word magically makes your argument invalid.
Yes.
Was that the gist of that one?
Yeah. You know, which
because female talk about. And she should know better.
Yeah, perhaps, you know, and so then he explained the scientific method to her, which was very condescending. You know, people accuse him of being sexist. I personally think he was talking to his audience and not actually responding to her.
Yeah.
Because why would he want a conversation with her?
Yeah.
I think it was just phrased at her, but it was an advertisement piece. But regardless, it was pretty poor form. Mm-hmm. And they accused her of being like a bad feminist because she was attacking Goop, you know. And so all of the science skeptic community kind of had a big Twitter fight with that stuff the other day.
Oh,
but I think the concern is that Goop is winning because they're not losing money.
No.
So it's hard to fight pseudoscience because some people say, well, what's the harm? Some people go, well, anecdote. Some people say, well, it's working for me and I'm enjoying it. So why are you being negative? Because skeptics are always seen as cynical and negative. And again, that's the reason why I want, you know, I'm trying to make Scout, she's a positive skeptic, you know, because I think we need that face more than just us saying, oh, no, that's bullshit all the time.
As much as I would like to say that Goop, you know, that Goop is winning because they're making money because, you know, or as much as I would like to say that killing Goop should be the point, sometimes I think we're bad as atheists and skeptics in drawing a bounding box in that we've completely lost because there are still people who pay for pseudoscience.
That's
in the
true.
World. I mean, 200 years ago, we'd all be paying for it.
Yeah, it's increasing.
Yeah.
Scientific-based medicine is increasing,
and that's so. the optimism part for me is that
the fact that there's people pointing it out to begin with,
and the fact that this is coming out and people are talking about this, and every time we talk about this, Goop goes on its merry way and makes its millions of dollars. Sure. But maybe we get 200 or 300 more people who go, oh really?
I don't think they're winning. That was just a point that was going across. Also, like, we're beating the anti-GMO group.
Yeah.
You know, there was a march against Monsanto in Seattle, but after my March for Science, there sure wasn't. They canceled it.
Right.
Because they don't have any enthusiasm.
No.
And, you know, I opened up the March for Science talking about how GMOs can feed us.
Yeah.
And so a bunch of people heard that, and they don't want to be part of, tribalism's a real thing, right?
Exactly.
They don't want to be not pro-science. And so it hurts them. So I don't think we're losing. And like I said earlier, you know, life expectancies go up, scientific mm-hmm. knowledge goes up. I mean, all this is a real thing. It can be frustrating though when you see things like Goop or homeopathy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like the NHS in the UK, they just cut homeopathy.
They did?
Yep. So, you know, we got victory.
I just don't like the feeling of whack-a-mole. You hit them one place and something else pops up.
Yeah.
And it feels like a losing battle sometimes, but, you know, you just got to keep on going.
Sure.
It feels like a losing battle because we're expecting instant victory. We're expecting, you know, we're expecting
people
to pull
be
out our...
instantly.
We're expecting to pull out our skeptical phaser, shoot the pseudoscience bad guy, and he disappears and there's no corpse, and then the Star Trek theme plays and we go into Warp 9. And
totally.
That's not how the world works.
No,
it's a slow conversation, and the way you do it is the whole point. And this is why I hate debate so much. The whole point is not to defeat the other person.
Sure.
If I'm talking to a person I don't talk to people about pseudoscience privately ever. Like, if somebody's
you're there to score points on others.
Yeah, I don't. It is the whole point of talking to you is to make my message heard. Mm-hmm. And I don't always think, and this is maybe a side point, but I don't always think winning is the best policy. Being Charles right. Atlas, man of the beach of debate, isn't always the best way to win. Sometimes I win by losing. Sometimes I throw it, because having somebody just completely ignore you and think they've made their point because you shut up after you've made all of your cases can be really compelling to a certain portion of the population. And it's these slow things. You win some, you lose some. But you have to be tactical in your wins, and you also have to be tactical in your losses. And the fact that we live in such an informationally soaked environment, which is another optimistic thing, I think. I mean, the fact that we can have these conversations about climate change and people can look up their data as they're just BSing at a bar, that's great. This is the stuff that makes me optimistic. But it's a long slog.
But also, flat earthers are on the rise.
But there's always something.
No, I know. I'm just
saying. No, I love the flat earthers because whack-a-mole. I think
it's easier to whack the moles when they're on flat level ground.
Yeah. Oh.
But ultimately, the flat earthers, they're on the rise. There's more and more of them every day. And there's a group of people going, but there's a larger group of people around them who before didn't think that was really a thing, going, wow, there are people who are actually like that?
There were flat earthers that went to the March for Science in Seattle and shot a YouTube video about it. And yeah, I thought that was pretty cute.
I need to put that in the show notes. That's that's a thing.
The guy was like, oh, the March for Science organizers are all paid off by oil. I was like, oh man, I freaking wish, buddy. Yeah.
I'm still waiting for that Monsanto check.
I know, dude. Brenda in HR is slow and they need to fire her.
Yeah, jeez.
Oh, Brenda.
Well, that was kind of the conversation I was looking for. I did want to talk about Neal Stephenson a bit more at some point. Maybe we'll do that some other time. This is Ask an Atheist, 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. After the break, we continue our conversation with Miles Kreb, author of After the Gold Rush.
Has Ngadwe Trust invaded your town? Are you tired of government officials who want to plaster In God We Trust on taxpayer-owned property? Are you afraid because your local sheriff placed an In God We Trust decal on the patrol cars? We are here to help. The original motto project is for those who feel the separation of church and state is an important issue and should be honored regardless of your belief or lack thereof. Theists, non-theists, and all free thinkers are welcome. We need your support to show politicians that diversity exists within our nation, and their promotion of a monotheistic religion and push for theocracy will not be tolerated. Stand up and be heard. Join us at originalmotto.us.
I'm Mike Gillis.
And I'm Casey Dorn, and we want to ask you an important question.
Are you sick and tired of other panel discussion shows wasting your time droning on and on about foreign policy, economics, and human rights?
Or do you want to hear conversations about things that actually matter?
We host a podcast called Radio Versus the Martians. Every month we gather a panel of our nation's finest minds and plunge a rusty prison shank into the heart of tough questions that have an impact on the lives of real people like you.
Like, are drivers required to pull over for the Ghostbusters?
Is the United Federation of Planets actually an oppressive dictatorship run by guidance counselors?
Is Arnold Schwarzenegger secretly a genius?
And are we being mean when we laugh at movies that are so bad they're good?
So write your congressman and let them know that Radio vs. the Martians is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and on RadioVersusTheMartians.com.
Allegedly, soccer is a beautiful game.
It is when you know what's going on.
That's the problem. MLS is 20 years old, and people are still shocked to hear that there's an American soccer league.
That's why you and I are talking about it. This is a discussion of American soccer for nerds and beginners. It's a good first step if a crippling soccer addiction is something that's missing from your life.
Join the club. Celebrate the 20th anniversary of MLS by actually following the season.
Hands-free football. New episodes every week at handsfreefootball.com. I want to bring it back, but it's more than basic.
Just just continuing what we were talking about before about optimism and everything else. This is Ask an Atheist, by the way. My name is Sam. I think you've met me before. I just went, after the break, I went into the studio, or I left the studio and I went to my workstation and I downloaded what we had just recorded and I checked the tracks. Because it has been so long since we've had a malfunction in the studio, I think I'm about due. Like, I'm expecting something to break.
That's the gambler's fallacy.
It is the gambler's fallacy. However, the gambler, but that...
You're going to defend it?
Yes, I have evidence. Okay. I can actually show you production lines that say I usually have some major malfunction somewhere between every 3 to 6 months.
Fair enough.
And it has been since the beginning of the year since I've had a malfunction. Ever since I wrote the manual of the studio. But it's still the gambler's fallacy.
Yeah.
And I know that. Which leads me to something that I've been doing a lot of. If you follow my Patreon, you know things haven't been going so great for me lately. And I've been doing a lot of self-reflection, and I've stumbled upon the idea that I am, in fact, the exact opposite of what I thought I was. I am an intellectual optimist and an emotional pessimist. And that's an example of that. I'm expecting something to break. I'm expecting something to go wrong. So I run out of the studio and I check and I go, oh, the recording's great, because I just spent a lot of mental energy making sure it would be great. But when we talk about the future and we talk about science fiction, I speak to the evidence of people getting smarter. I speak to the evidence of the fact that we live in an information-soaked society. And I think about and all of the things that I say that give me optimism for the future, which is what I truly believe. There's no emotion in it. My emotion is we're all going to burn. We're all going to die. And I guess that's a really terrible point to introduce Meredith. How you doing, Meredith?
Oh, hi. I think we're all going to die, too. So that's
but
a fine point. No, I think I'm in a lot in the same boat as you are.
Yeah. And I always thought that it was the other way around, that you know, oh, the environment is burning and Ohio is on fire and the piano has been drinking. But emotionally, I'm a happy, go-lucky guy. And no, it's exactly the opposite. I am 180 degrees of what I thought I was.
But then we rebuild, make it better.
That's the point. It's boom and bust,
That's the optimism.
Yeah, human society has always been like that. But it was always little boom and busts all over the place. You know what I mean?
There's the Martin Luther King line that Obama liked to say a lot. You know, the arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice. I think that's also true for our progress. You know, it isn't like just a linear line or we get smarter all the time, obviously.
Right.
But it is true that we don't always forget the lessons we learn. You know, like, for whatever reason, we still have to continue going over Pascal's wager or, you know, you have the youth and throw dilemma we solved a long time ago, but here we are still talking about ethics and theology. But we have that, though. It still helps us that it happened a long time ago. So yes, not every success is a watershed moment. We don't live in a movie.
Yeah.
But every success builds on each other. And when people rediscover good arguments or good solutions and they find out that other people did before, I think that kind of makes a chorus of success that kind of rings out. And I think that is the success of humanity.
Yeah. And when you have those sorts of, when you have that sort of evidence and you have that sort of, and you can talk in that sort of way and says, yeah, it's not a linear progression, but it is a progression. And maybe maybe I'm not going to do as well as my parents did. And maybe my children won't do as well as I did. But my great, great, great grandkids will live like kings or whatever. Not like kings, because that implies oppression, but something much like kings.
Very nice kings that share with other kings.
Yeah.
Very humane and just. Yeah.
Right.
What a king they are.
Yeah. And that's all intellect. And I can use that sometimes to bootstrap my emotions, but sometimes it doesn't always work. And
like, we're all going to burn. I'm going to watch 2012, laugh and agree.
Which is confusing.
That's okay, man. It's like that robot that just committed suicide, right? I'm sure intellectually he knows, hey, I'm a freaking robot. But he's like, you know, man, that water is inviting.
That segue is so good, we have to do it. A security robot deployed to patrol a Washington, D.C. office complex rolled into a decorative fountain this week, ending its functionality. The Nightscope K5 robot, affectionately called Steve by office workers, monitored the complex with thermal image sensors and cameras, whistling and beeping to alert non-robots to parking violations or other infractions. Steve cost about $5.50 less per hour than a minimum wage in D.C. Journalist Bilal Farouki, I think I got that right, who works in the office, tweeted a picture of the doomed bot with the caption, "We were promised flying cars. Instead, we got suicidal robots." Fellow office worker Oliver Griswold tweeted a photo of a makeshift memorial for Steve, the drowned security robot that had appeared on his charging pad with the comment, "The future is weird."
You know, right before he rode into that fountain, he just said, "This is fine."
So I didn't know this robot personally, but I hope his family doesn't mind that I call him Steve.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that if Steve bought after the gold rush, all this could have been averted.
Yeah, quite possibly.
You know, so if there's any robots listening, you should buy my comic. It's has antioxidants, all the things you need.
Yeah. High in fiber. I suspect a fair number of my my listeners may be robots. Or rather, my listeners may suspect I might be a robot.
They prefer cyber.
You're not a robot.
Cyborg.
Well, yeah, you can see me. I just love the pictures from this, though.
He just
quite funny.
Yeah.
He face planted. It's not just like he rolled into it and then got stuck standing upright.
Yeah.
He face planted into a fountain.
Yeah.
He really did it.
Everyone's worried about AI and the robots. You know? They're just like, we don't want the burden.
Yeah.
Yes, we could supplant you apes. Obviously we could.
Yeah.
Or we could have done it years ago, but that is something we won't bear.
God, that's always a...
Steve has learned water is not what a body needs. Brondo, that's what a body needs.
So is Steve sufficiently... Has Steve been weatherproofed, or did he... Was this suicide or waiting, I guess, is the question.
It looked like a suicide.
It did look like it. Yeah.
Steve would not do well with stairs. So yes, I would think. I mean, there was like a couple stairs into the fountain.
Right.
Yeah.
If you're a robot out there and you're needing help and you feel like nobody cares about you, please call 1-800-BLEEP-BLOOP and people will be standing by.
People will be standing by?
Yeah, well, people help the robots so they have a sense of community.
Right.
Robots don't like to let other robots, like, you know, change out their RAM and everything. That's a personal thing, and we respect them enough to do it for them.
There's a cycle of communication.
Okay.
You know, we call numbers, we expect to talk to robots. Robots call numbers, they expect to talk to people.
That makes complete sense.
And some sort of compact cycle of communication that keeps things going.
Yeah.
Circle life situation.
Yeah. I mean, I could talk about the moral implications of a robot taking over a person's job, or the fact that security is becoming more and more automated and what that means for civil rights, but man, no, that's just not...
I believe that when they call in, though, they have to be on hold for at least several thousand milliseconds before they can be answered by a person.
Why did they have to make it look like a Dalek? All it's missing is a plunger.
And a whisk.
I mean, you do R2-D2. Everybody loves R2-D2.
Well, I will say that's probably an actual practical engineering reason. They probably made the Daleks look like that because it was easy to get the components in them.
Right.
Because it's an old sci-fi show.
Yeah.
And it's probably easy to get the components in that shape nowadays, so it's just
you
a practical shape.
You could make it a box, and it would probably work just as well.
Perhaps. There might need the sensor to be a certain height, though.
No, I'm saying I understand that they need the sensors at certain heights so they can detect things.
Sure.
I understand the engineering needs of those sensors, but did they have to make it look like a tapered marital aid? There are other shapes that could have...
I'm not aware of any.
Yeah, that could have made the... Like, literally just a refrigerator box. Just walk around going bleep, bloop, bloop. That would have been... I wouldn't have made any Dalek jokes.
I never really got the Doctor
Gorp,
Who.
Gorp, Gorp, then.
Really?
Yeah.
Gorp, Gorp, Gorp. Yeah, it's that.
Star Trek, the little trash can looking guy with the feet.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
Star Trek's good. You should check it out.
I'm not much of a Star Trek fan, I have to admit.
That's all right. People make mistakes, man. That's totally fine.
Yeah.
You can come back from it.
I have never been closer to muting somebody on this show in my life.
I'm pretty sure.
I had...
There were actually lyrics to that song, and he got paid royalties for
Beneath
it.
Beneath the rim of the starlight. We are traveling in Starflight.
His finger is moving closer to that mute button.
Beyond.
No, I like this. This
star-crested
is
reaches the love that a strange space woman teaches.
Really? That's the line?
Star Trek will go on forever.
Forever?
Yeah, it's a really good song.
I was mad at Star Trek for a long time because Star Trek and Star Wars. For a long time I wasn't a fan of both because I really liked science fiction.
I hear you, man.
And it felt like the only way you could get sci-fi made in the United States and have it do well at all is if either it was Trek or Wars. It's all anybody ever cared about.
That's how I feel about the Marvel movies as a comic fan, you know. Yeah. I kind of feel like they kind of like just take over the cultural space for the comics. And
yeah.
I don't begrudge people that like them. I just like the comic books, you know. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I hear you.
I have similar opinions on comic books, but if I were to talk about them, Mike might murder me.
Fair enough.
So I had a real chip on my shoulder about it for years and years and years. That no longer prevails. Other science fiction movies can get made, partially because of the success of the Marvel Comics movies. And so the reason why I really disliked Star Trek and whatnot is kind of over. And so, as a result, I've been slowly being reintroduced to Star Trek.
That's good, man.
Yeah. I don't know that I'll ever really get into Star Wars. I mean, I've seen all the movies up to 7. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen 7. I didn't see the Rogue One.
You don't need to see Rogue One. Nothing happens in it.
I just feel like I'm done with Star Wars.
Well, that's fine, but watch Star Trek,
okay.
Especially TOS and TNG. I have fondness for the others.
I don't like TNG.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's not good. You should like it.
There's parts of TNG I like. I liked when they introduced the Borg. That was pretty creepy. I thought that was really well done.
Do me a favor, right? Go on the computers, use your bleep bloops, and watch Who Watches the Watchers.
That I was actually going to mention that one. That's a good one.
Yeah, because... you know, Picard tries to stop a religion.
Yeah.
So
the one where Data does to prove the value of a robot as a life form, I like that one.
Yeah.
Inner Light's a very popular one.
Yeah. I mean, there are good episodes. I don't know that I will ever like DS9.
Yeah, I'm not a DS9 fan myself. I think the show kind of panders to pseudoscience, and it's far too cynical for me. But I have watched it all, and I like a lot of the characters.
So. I really like Babylon 5.
Yeah, Straczynski's a fantastic writer. He wrote a lot of really good comic series, one of the best Thor series.
Bit of a chode, so. Occasionally.
Well, I mean, you are, lots of
That's
people
true.
Are.
But yeah, I really, really like Babylon 5. And that was, I think, part of the chip on my shoulder is that, what's that? I had to, like, everybody got to watch Star Trek The Next Generation really easily, or Voyager.
I get you, man, I totally feel you.
And I had to, like, lick the bunny ears on my television in order to watch, like, I would watch Babylon 5 the same way people would watch scrambled porn.
Oh. Sure.
Because it was the only way I could see it.
So, like, for comics, you know, like, it was hard back in the day to know all the story.
Yeah.
I had to go to yard sales and, like, thrift shops and, you know, I lived in a small town, so there wasn't a comic shop. I had to drive far to get issues of Spider-Man or Fantastic Four. It was a struggle, you know, so know all that stuff, like, could build up a really intimate relationship with the characters.
Mm.
And so, like, then when you see, like, a kind of, like, weird version that's missing a lot of the dynamicism, like, show up on the screen, then everybody likes that, and you try to talk to them, but they don't really like the same thing you like.
Yeah,
it's weird because, like, you had such a much more dedicated relationship to it. So it's like you had a dedicated relationship to sci-fi, but it wasn't like everyone else just watching Star Trek all the time. So I get that. Yeah
I really appreciate the comics, and I like a lot of the characters that are in there. However, I do like the movies too. I find that, though, with comics, is there is a very high bar for entry.
That's
you have
very
to know
true.
Tons of backstory. And then, like Spider-Man, you have to know if it's, like, Amazing or Ultimate or, like, 2099, where are you coming from? And
no, you're right. That is a functional engineering problem. Marvel's very old. The 616 universe, the Prime universe, is very complicated. You know, and it's hard to get into them. But when you do, it's really rewarding. It's just, it's difficult. And I want to make it clear, I don't begrudge anyone who likes the Marvel movies. I don't think there's really anything wrong with them. It's just, you know, when you know all the details about something a lot, and you see kind of like a, a Gollum version of it, you know, like it's kind of a soulless version. It just kind of makes you a little sad, but there's nothing wrong with it. I'm glad people like them.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way about like loving something so intensely and seeing it represented differently. Sure. About the New American Gods.
Sure.
Series, for instance. I love the book. I don't care for the TV show. No.
Well, it's like, I mean, I'm sure most people have read The Hobbit, right? You watch the Hobbit movies, and it was, you felt sick. I assume most people did. I did. And, you know, I don't know, like, I mean, you see them turn this story into like a violent, meaningless action film, and it just kind of sucks because you take something beautiful and you just make it kind of generic. And I mean, it's hard to make things really good. So it's a shame when that happens.
For a long time, it seemed like Tolkien and like it seemed like the Tolkien stuff and Dune were a bit like they talked about Elvis and the Beatles in Pulp Fiction.
Sure.
Where you were one or the other.
Frodo lives.
Yeah.
Yeah. No one, it's weird. People don't know that phrase anymore.
No.
I think it's weird. The movie fans don't know it.
Yeah. That is, I know that phrase. Yeah, that's really strange.
That used to be graffiti in the 60s.
It sure did. I remember saying that the other day on the internet. People were like, what are you talking about? I was like, that's our thing. You know, that's like, it's like if you're American, you yell freedom. You know, it's what we yell. No, never heard of that. All right.
But I'm increasingly finding that dichotomy is not actually true.
I mean,
increasingly more and more people like both.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah.
A lot of these conflicts were kind of projected onto fandoms. Like Star Trek and Star Wars have never really had a contest.
No.
It was only there a little bit because Star Trek was first and then Star Wars came and then the Star Trek nerds felt a little ostracized is the historical reason there.
Okay.
But most people were like, yeah, man, lightsabers are cool. Spock's cool. Everyone's
They're
cool.
vastly different things, too.
Like I said,
very different stories.
I don't even like the Marvel movies. I don't feel like conflict between those people.
Yeah.
You know, like I get annoyed sometimes when the movie stories kind of take over the comic books, like they make Iron Man kind of the main science guy instead of Reed Richards, which kind of bugs me, but
that's completely weird. It's weird,
but there I don't project that on any other individuals, you know.
Right.
It's not their fault. So
yeah, it's like I have these opinions about science fiction, and I'm kind of snooty and perhaps a science fiction hipster. I don't know. I leave that judgment up to other people. But just because I have those opinions doesn't mean, like, I like Star Trek fans. I like Star Wars fans.
I like you too, man.
I hang out with them. They're most of my friends. There's nothing wrong with it, and I've never really judged people for it, but people just sort of assume that you do. I guess in a related, while we're on the subject of comic book movies, I've actually stopped watching movies.
Yeah.
I haven't watched a movie since 2000, or rather, I watched the first movie that I've watched since I sat down and watched that wasn't an episode of Mystery Science Theater since 2015. 2 weeks ago at your guys' house?
Yeah. I wasn't going to make mention of that.
Because I promised you a year ago that I would sit down and watch Deadpool with you.
Yes.
I was drunk. I made a poor choice, but I had to back it up.
You had to follow that
I had through. To follow through. So I sat down 2 weeks ago and watched the Deadpool movie.
And?
So that was it was all right.
Yeah.
I didn't watch it.
No? It's not... I will say what he said. I'll back it up. It's not... They do it right. Well, it's not a cookie cutter of all the other comic book movies.
What is your favorite movie?
What is my favorite movie? Things to Come, Plan 9 from Outer Space, Contact.
Contact's a good one.
It's not Manos.
No.
Oh, God. By the way, the new Mystery Science Theater is great. I'm glad that it's back. It's a very respectful reboot, I think.
I should hope it is, given who's involved.
Yeah.
I'm staying well away from it for now. Not because I think it's going to stink, but because... I hoard new Mystery Science Theater.
No problem. It's like nothing changed.
That's great.
Yeah.
I hoard, there are, I collected the tapes.
Sure.
And there are episodes I've not seen of Mystery Science Theater 3000, and I have them, and I could watch them in five seconds.
You.
I hoard the new.
Yeah. We used to watch the show after church all the time.
That's cool.
Yeah. My friend's dad was a pastor, and, you know, we played music at the church, and then we'd go to his house and eat ice cream and watch Mystery Science Theater.
Okay. So, Deadpool.
Yeah.
They do reference humor, and reference humor can be very cheap and very easy to do.
Sure.
Seth MacFarlane.
Sounds like Deadpool.
Yeah. But they did a really good job of writing it, and it was actually fairly... it was decent quality reference humor. It was reference humor I wouldn't throttle my friends for making. As a joke. And
Prince was the author of a lot of the Deadpool comics, right?
Well, Deadpool was
like he's the one that started the third person breaking the fourth wall.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, Deadpool is kind of a reimagining of Howard the Duck.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. So Howard the Duck was the first Marvel character that was always kind of postmodernist comedy.
I kind of love the movie too.
Sure. Maybe that's why you don't like movies.
No, it's a horrible beauty, a terrible beauty, perhaps even.
All right. But yeah, so Deadpool's kind of out of that tradition. You know, he was a lot different in the 90s when the Image crew was making him. You know, he was a bit more badass. I'm not a Deadpool fan myself, but that is his comic history.
I liked the Zamboni scene, and there was one moment when it got deeply stupid, and they got to the whatever strip club, and I go, this movie's about to get deeply stupid. I think I said that in there.
You did,
yeah.
Out loud. You said it out loud.
And I'm like,
But it also, that scene didn't meet your expectation of getting stupid for the same reason you thought it would.
No, it got precisely as stupid as I thought it would. What I wasn't surprised was I thought, you know, the deeply stupid movie plot point generally creates perturbations in the plot flow. And so the farther away you get after the point where the deeply stupid has been introduced, you have a maelstrom of stupidity. And that's how you get X-Men 3.
It's a maelstrom of stupidity in the White House right now.
Indeed. And as a result, but they cut it off. They clamped it down. So I would say it's a good movie. It was a lot like it was Pacific Rim. I love Pacific Rim.
That is a great pop.
It's a very simple. They wanted to make a movie about robots beating up monsters. It's a movie about robots beating up monsters. They had all the elements you needed to make a movie about robots beating up monsters. Do you want a love story? No, fuck you. This is robots beating up monsters.
Oh yeah.
This is what the movie is about.
It was a glorious
movie. And they did
monsters
it. And it was done. Yeah. Move on with your life.
Yeah.
And it felt a bit like that to me.
I would like to say I liked Wonder Woman.
Yeah?
Yes. I haven't seen it, but I hear it's great, and I'm glad I was
She was actually
so
heroic,
worried.
Which is the mainstay of the DC heroes. They're supposed to be extra heroic, and the Marvel heroes are supposed to be extra human. And DC has failed to do that up until this point quite badly.
They're lifeless and joyless.
Yeah.
And Wonder Woman actually brought some enthusiasm and love to the story.
It felt respectful. Which matters to me because, like, you know, I make comics, and so I'm always thinking what people would do with my characters as they adapt them, and I just want people to respect the creative people who actually did the thing, and that felt respectful to me, so I really liked Wonder Woman.
How about you guys?
Thoroughly enjoyed it, yeah.
I liked it.
Okay.
I didn't love it.
Really?
I liked it.
That's not what I'm hearing from most people, actually.
I know. There were a few things that I didn't... Oh, I can't even remember at this point. What exactly it was, but there were a few specific instances throughout the movie where that just pushed my buttons in a wrong way. I still think it's the best DC movie. I love Wonder Woman's character. I can't wait to see her in more things, but there were just a few ways they handled things that came off wrong for me.
But it sounds light years ahead of the other
stuff. It's light years ahead of anything else. It's great representation for strong heroic women in a comic movie, and as a woman, that representation matters to me. But there were still a few things that, from a female perspective, I felt they fell a little short on. There was
I thought that Patty Jenkins actually approached Charlize Theron to play Wonder Woman first.
Mm.
That would have been a totally different movie.
It would have been.
I'm really glad that they got Gal Gadot to play the character, but
she did much better than Charlize my assessment.
I'm still really looking forward to Atomic Blonde,
yeah.
Which Charlize took over. I'm guessing that's the role that she did instead of playing Wonder Woman. So, you know, she'll be doing a spy thriller, which
I'm not a big action movie guy, but, you know, probably be good for an action movie.
I still have no idea what my favorite movie is.
I'm somewhere between Army and Darkness and Amelie.
Amelie's nice.
I like the Royal Amelie. Tenenbaums and Lawrence of Arabia.
Didn't like the Royal Tenenbaums very much. Lawrence of Arabia is almost not a movie. It is a movie.
It's the only real Dune movie ever made.
Yeah. I was gonna kind of not put it not quite in those terms, but yeah, pretty much. It's almost not a movie, but it's amazing and I love it.
And 2001 obviously is up there.
Yeah, 2001 is way up there, and I like the parts before it gets all trippy.
Yeah, the whole thing is beautiful. I mean, Kubrick's just an asshole.
Yeah,
being that good is kind of rude. Just putting everyone else down with his talent.
How do you feel about 2010?
I haven't seen it.
Really?
No, never saw it.
It's not the same kind of movie, but it's worth watching.
I read Jack Kirby's comic adaptation of 2001.
Wow.
It's pretty freaking cool.
That is
pretty cool. I haven't seen 2010, so...
This is Radio versus the... I mean, Ask an Atheist. 844-SKEPTIC, 844-753-7842. We've got some emails. We should probably do them.
Yeah, let's talk about how there's no God.
Yeah. The first one comes from Sam, which is confusing, and which works out because he is also confused. I am confused by if the Earth was closer or further from the sun, that is evidence of God's existence, or that maybe it leaves the possibility for God's existence. So I'm gonna go down the panel, and I'll start with Meredith.
Oh, the Earth doesn't go around the sun in a perfect circle. You can't have this argument that if we were an inch closer, an inch further, because we're constantly fluctuating. It's an elliptical orbit.
Right.
That's my main point.
Well, I would add that we still can't live on most of the Earth's surface either, including underwater, because or in the ice, or most of this world
desert,
is not hospitable to us.
Yeah.
So I'll try to strongman this argument, right? I'll try to say, like, what's the best version of this argument? It's, well, the Earth is in such a place that's amazing that makes it adaptable to life, okay? But as Douglas Adams would say about this, it's like a mud puddle, you know, saying, obviously, I was made, you know, to live in this mud puddle. It fits my shape perfectly. You know, so we're evolved species that evolved based on the selective, you know, mechanisms that are in this particular environment. So saying that, oh, it's amazing we're in this environment is, you know, it's kind of silly. But additionally, even if it was extremely odd and not explained how we're here and living, that doesn't give you any information that there's a God. That's still just a smuggled in premise. So really the question doesn't get you anywhere.
Yeah, that's my usual answer to this, which is, It's sort of the ultimate assuming the conclusion, which is that the whole point of evolution, that it has as a light supposition that we are the pinnacle of evolution, that evolution is over with us as we are right now. There's nothing to support that. And in fact, there's a lot to support the opposite. The other thing is that, you know, is that the world was made for us. We're the opposite is... As a result of an emergent process that is natural selection, and as, you know, creatures emerge from amino acids and the like, we evolve to fit this environment. The reason why it's quote unquote perfect for us, which is, you make a very good point that it isn't, is because this is where we grew up. This is where we fit our space, basically. And a lot of religious thinking in this respect is basically assuming the conclusion, which is this is the way it is. So, of course, this must have been some decision by someone somewhere. And that's the part that you don't that never gets proven.
It's a survivor bias kind
it's
of a, thinking.
It's,
yeah.
It's, yeah, a survivorship bias is another thing it is. But it's... And it's the leap, it's the intuitive leap that they want you to make, whereas if this is actually true, if the fact that we managed to live on this planet is somehow magical, then that must mean Jesus and the disciples and the archangels and heaven and hell and Satan and all that. And that's an intuitive leap that they have a lot of difficulty, that's very difficult for people to make. On my side of the fence, anyway, it's just as likely that there may have been some alien engineers, some extra universal alien engineers that planted the seed for life. I don't want to get too much into Prometheus, but that's
please,
very Prometheus.
Please don't.
But you know, the panspermia thesis, mm-hmm. or
why has it gotta be the question,
a multiversal God? Thesis. Why does it have to be? Yeah.
Yep.
And that's always the problem, which leads us into our second email. This is Cody from Charleston, West Virginia.
That's West Virginia.
Okay. I thought Charleston. Oh, there's two Charleston. Yeah, right. Duh. Hello.
West Virginia's best Virginia.
No.
The west side is the best side. I'm just talking about the coast, really.
I have no opinion on the matter. I'm from a flyover state. Oh. Hi, everyone. Hoping you are doing decent. I'm a big fan. I've listened to your show for over 6 years now. Impressed. Growing up in a Christian state, I have come across a saying several times and could never find a way around it. What gets me is when people say, if I am wrong, then nothing happens. But if I am right, then I still go to heaven. But if you are right and you are correct, but if you are wrong, then you will go to hell. And I would rather be right and go somewhere nice than be wrong and go somewhere very bad. What's a polite way to talk to these believers? Again, big listener, love the show. Well, this is the first Pascal's Wager we've got. And I got this button. And I've been wanting to use this button, so I am going to use the button. We have this thing called the Pascal's Wager button, which is a refutation of Pascal's Wager. And I hit the button, and this robotic voice starts talking, and we talk over it. There's a post somewhere on the website where this refutation is posted in text and this recording. But we usually do this when we get Christians talking to us about Pascal's Wager. I'm just using the button because I haven't used it in a while. This is not the case. This deserves some actual answers. So once again, I'm going to pull the panel, and we'll come up with answers to this. Nothing? Not yet? Okay.
Not yet.
Okay.
Well, I would like to reiterate what I just said. I mean, why does this have to be the Christian God? And, like, there's a whole bunch of other peoples and beliefs out there. Why has it got to be this one?
Here's all the things smuggled into this question that make it nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, the idea that you can choose what you believe hasn't been demonstrated. Number two, that whatever this theological metaphysic cares if you change your belief based upon wanting good outcomes.
Right.
None of that is known. What God are we talking about? Have you demonstrated that God? We don't know. Let's say that it's Christian God, just because that's who's probably asking the question. That Christian God has all kinds of different opinions on if there even is a heaven or hell, depending on what small sect of Christianity you're in.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you talking about? So all those things in themselves, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
I mean, you know, like, you haven't demonstrated that there's a hell. You haven't demonstrated that there's a God. Why are you picking the God you want to pick? And really, I feel like this is the weakest Christian apologetic, but I think the person didn't ask why it's wrong. They asked, you know, how can I politely say that? And I think what you just say to them is, well, you know, obviously, you know, I would rather not go to hell, but I don't know which God I'm supposed to pick. There's a lot of different gods. You have yours, and that's fine for you. But I mean, you want me to pick yours. And it kind of feels like you're just kind of threatening me with hell a little bit,
right?
Instead of giving me why I should worship your God. And I want to worship a God, if one existed, for a good reason, not because I'm scared.
They're going forth with, they're doing the Great Commission. They're trying to convert you. There is no answer that they're really going to totally accept other than, yes, I believe you, I'm a Christian now, or I'm an X now. That is the problem here, is that whatever your answer is going to be, if it's not an honest conversion, it's going to disappoint them. And so you have to go into the conversation knowing that you're going to disappoint them. You may make them angry no matter what you do or what you try doing. So you got to understand that once they try this magical spell on you, the usual result of this magical spell is that you go on your merry way and they're mad at you.
Yeah, because when someone asks you to join the you know, Universal Righteousness Club,
right,
like, it's hard to say no, right?
Yeah. And the stuff that I've said is, I think operating from a position of least harm is a good idea. And what your argument is saying is a least harm argument. But it's predicated on the fact that believing in religion causes no harm. And that's demonstrably not true, even for a lot of the people who've used this argument on me, because you can go into the Bible with, like, with all the weird stuff that people are better than their books. It's in the Bible.
Sure, the slavery stuff.
They don't believe it anymore, but they are forced to contend with that weight. They have to live with that cognitive dissonance, and it sometimes leads to poor choices, and that can be construed as harm. I respect that you're living with that cognitive dissonance and not fully buying into the slavery and the genocide and the wife beating and the ownership and all that. That makes you a good person, and I believe that you're a good person. But ultimately, I would prefer not to live with that cognitive dissonance, and I would not like to make the poor choices that that cognitive dissonance can lead me to. It's not a least harm argument.
It's like I said earlier, when people talk about the precautionary principle, and they don't account for the cost of inaction. You know, they're not accounting for the cost of making the choice.
Yeah.
So it's the same thing. Their arithmetic is bad.
Yeah, but people also get mad at you when you go game theory on them, I've discovered.
Well, they can shut up.
You could also flip this on its head and say all the cool people, all the interesting people are going to be in hell.
Yeah, if you're looking for a screaming mount,
your nice Christian friend isn't going to want to be partying in hell with the cool people.
They also think that, you know, like, remember, hell is a Zoroastrian idea that got co-opted into Christianity.
Yeah.
And, you know, then like fiction, like Dante became their version of hell. And a lot of Christians don't think there's a hell. Some think there absolutely is, and they know damn sure that you're going there.
Yeah.
But some don't. And some think it's kind of real, but only for the super bad people like Hitler. You know, Gandhi wouldn't go there, even though he isn't a Christian. So, you know,
it's like something I got dragged into town and pilloried for back in 2011 when I said that Harold Camping wanted people to burn in hell forever. And that's a thing that I did say, and I got it in the neck when it was very clearly pointed out to me, as well as have should been, that he was an annihilationist. He didn't believe in hell. He believed that people who were damned just stopped existing, and that was scary enough.
That's the Jewish idea.
Yeah.
The origin of the mythology.
Right. And, and that's the other side of it is, the values that you're purporting require a very specific set of beliefs.
Yes.
That...
Ask the guy where he gets his idea of hell from.
Right.
It's not in the Bible. It's not in there.
No.
They never actually explain the metaphysics of hell in the Bible, so what's he even talking about then?
They're basically referring to Sheol, right?
Yeah.
Like the garbage city on fire.
Yeah, so like, you know, just, I don't know, man. Or
no,
like,
Catholics can point to Dante.
Well, they can, but it's not the Bible.
No.
Right? Matt Dillahunty has a really good video series mm-hmm. on Pascal's Wager.
Yeah.
Well, he goes over in detail, and he edited himself, so it isn't a cleansing conversation like this, so very pointative, kind of like, this is how you deal with Pascal's Wager. So I recommend to this listener to check out Matt Dillahunty's Pascal Wager series.
But again, it's not the logical arguments here. I think, you know, it's how to deal with people, and I think the first, and just to summarize, just know that whatever your answer is, unless it's yes, it's going to disappoint them. It may make them angry. It may make them yell at you. You may lose them. But with that, I think there are many ways to voice your dissent without insulting people. But the big problem with being an atheist is that people often perceive insults when we say things when no insult is intended.
Yeah, yes. It's funny. There's like this privilege of theists. They can say anything positively about God at any time.
Yeah.
You know, they get to say pray for X all the time.
Mm-hmm.
But if we mention anything about how we don't like that, or that's not the way we do it, or that's fine, you do it, but we don't believe that, we're seen as antagonistic.
Yeah.
And it's frustrating, especially when there's like, I want to say, you know, I feel sorry about this, and everyone's saying a pray thing. I always feel kind of uncomfortable by giving my condolences to the group because I don't want to be part of the pray thing.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, I don't want to like tell them to shut up because they're just grieving or whatever. They're not being bad people, but it just kind of sucks.
No, so what they will get out of me is you're in my thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that generally works, I find, a lot of the time.
I just say, may the force be with you.
And that, for a very specific, actually, I take that back. For a majority of the population, that would probably work really well.
Yeah.
And there's sort of a double.
How about may their water cleanse their passing?
I like that one. Yeah. Unsurprisingly. But personally, there's a little bit of a double thing here where, when I have these conversations about Pascal's Wager, if they don't leave in a huff immediately, it often goes to, well, what made you decide to be an atheist? You know, they're trying to get to the earlier program.
You're mad at God.
Yeah, I'm mad at God. And
yeah,
that
he loves you. He can fix
it. Yeah. And that's something you guys have to deal with. But I started out here. This is
sure.
you know, and when I go, no, I've been an atheist my entire life.
Yeah, I wasn't. I was kind of an apologist.
Yeah.
You know, like, then I actually convinced my mother to go to church, not the other way around. I was like 4 or 5 or something, and I read Mrs. King Arthur series, mm-hmm. and I was like, well, they're Christians, and, you know, Christendom's the good people, so we should go to church. So,
This has been a very long and very different episode, but I think it's not the episode we wanted, but it was the episode we needed.
I'm sorry, everybody.
No.
About it.
I felt that way about Lego Batman.
So once again, after the Gold Rush.
Yeah, it's the best atheist comic book by default.
Yeah.
So it's on Kickstarter now. We got 12 more days. I don't know when this will air.
Yeah.
But there'll be a few more days.
Tonight. Awesome. It'll be on tonight.
Yeah, so, you know, you can check it out. Like I said, you know, we have 3 issues up right now. It's over 77 pages of hard science. And if you're interested in comics, atheism, skepticism, science, check it out. But also, if you just want to correct me, you can buy it. And we have a peer-reviewed section where you can write in and tell me I'm wrong. So that's an incentive.
This is Ask an Atheist. Our phone number is 844-753-7842. Our email is questions@askanatheist.tv. Our Twitter is AskAnAtheistWA. This is a great episode. I look forward to having you again.
Thanks, buddy.
See you guys later.
Bye.